Take it away.
Great. Thank you. Just for a moment, I need to speak to the future very briefly. My daughter is 4, and she wasn't terribly happy about me leaving to come up here. And when I told her that I would dedicate my talk to her, that made it seem okay. So, Zwi, this is for you. In the spirit of the how I'm going to open up this talk, essentially about a project that I've done in Los Angeles as well as Houston. It's a mobile radio transmission project. It's inspired by some sort of random, related and random concepts and other bodies of work, and is really interested in architectural and urban sort of questions and issues, social spatial conditions and things like that. That's sort of where we're starting. What a strange chaos is this wide atmosphere we breathe, is a quote from Charles Babbage, who's a British inventor, I think his Wikipedia page says polymath. And he was like late 1700s into the late 1800s. He's probably best known as the inventor of the proto-computer. He created a couple of inventions that were these grand computational devices. I believe the first one was called he called it the analytical engine, and the second one, which I believe this is a model of the second, his updated version, was called the difference engine. I guess as an aside, if you look into Babbage, and I don't know a whole lot about him, but he drew the scheme for this machine while he was alive in great detail, but he never built it. And they built it just in 1991, I suppose, and it worked exactly as he had predicted it would, just based off of his drawings. And I guess they used tolerances that were available to his era in making the machine, and it functioned exactly as he said it would, which is interesting. I was inspired by a section from his text called the Ninth Bridgewater Treatise. As I understand it, there was an Earl of Bridgewater who had written some texts in his time, and they had to do with science and religion and whatnot, and he had written 8 of them. And so Babbage wanted to officially reply to the discussion, and so he wrote the Ninth Bridgewater Treatise. I understand that he was sort of a natural philosopher in a way. He wanted to allow for the supernatural, and I think in a certain way he probably wanted to defend some sort of possibility of the miraculous, I guess I might say. And in fact, he perhaps was in a position making these great, precise computational machines to perhaps be seen as proving that there wasn't anything sort of unexpected in the universe, that if our analytical powers were great enough, we would be able to predict everything. And so he probably felt the need to write this treatise to sort of defend the unexpected. But this chapter that I was most inspired by is called On the Permanent Impression of Our Words and Actions on the Globe We Inhabit. And it's a very poetic, his whole treatise is actually quite poetic and imaginative and really provocatively written. Essentially, this chapter talks about when a sound, generates in the world, it affects, down to the molecular level, that the molecules of air, the atoms of air, and the energy transfers in increasing numbers throughout them, and essentially that it never goes away. It's always sort of in the air, and its change could be traced if you had sort of the computational power. You could trace, the origin. You could trace the sound and all of those things. He talks about the waves of air and also the waves of the ocean as being these kind of like recording materials that, you know, by being affected, by being inscribed, that they, in a sense, store the history of the world, which I thought was a very interesting notion of sonic space, especially as archaeological space, that it has this depth of time. He imagined this is us imagining the molecules of the world. He said something like I'll have to refer to it here in a second. The air being an invisible library, the air itself is one vast library, on whose pages are forever written all that man has ever said or woman whispered. There, in their mutable but unerring characters, mixed with the earliest as well as with the latest sighs of mortality, stand forever recorded, vows unredeemed, promises unfulfilled, perpetuating in the united movements of each particle the testimony of man's changeful will. So there's a bit of a somber quality to what he was writing about sound in the air, and a moment where he specifically takes up the idea of a kind of a social justice. He says, even the sounds of slave ships coming to the New World and people suffering in that, those sounds will forever be there, and you can ask the air to bear witness to what happened. And no man is required to bear witness, and no man can deny, you know, the atrocities that are happening, sort of thing, which was a sort of a you know, powerful sort of tragic thought, but really interesting, similar to the way that we've sort of talked about radio and how we think about radio also always sort of traveling. But here he literally just meant just the sound in and of itself. The other thing that I had in mind as I embarked on my project was some writings by J.G. Ballard, the British author, more contemporary, although he's passed away now. Some of his writings involve a kind of coming from like the fullness of that space that I'm using Babbage to talk about. I think Ballard, sometimes, at least in some texts, such as this short novel, High Rise, writes about the intensity and the fullness of this architectural space, the kind of pressure and brutality of this high-rise apartment building. Essentially, Ballard is considered a sci-fi author, but it's not so much, I'm sure you're familiar, but for those of you who aren't, his writing doesn't deal so much with let's say scenarios on other planets or things like that, as much as glitches that take place in a very familiar but maybe slightly distant future, or even the present of here. Some of his writings are much more otherworldly, but a lot of them are just have to do with sort of essentially the here and now, but sort of amplifying the intensity of something or taking a glitch very seriously and following its consequences. So in this case, it's all about this high-rise apartment building, about the social pressure, and literally about how the hierarchy of the topmost penthouses going all the way down. It's like this sort of utopia. Of course, it's set in like a Britain in the 1970s or something, so there's this idea of this sort of like making an enclave as a kind of fortress that, you know, protects one's, you know, sort of social identity as well as, you know, spatial identity and all this. Essentially, the inhabitants of this high-rise, things start breaking down, and they essentially start going crazy and turn into these savage tribes that essentially, you know, brutalize each other. And the scene opens up with a man sitting on the floor of his kitchen. And the opening line is something like, you know, in the dim light, you know, I forgot, I'm totally paraphrasing, something in the dim light, he sat on the kitchen floor eating a dog and never, you know, thought that he would be in this position or something. He's like, you know, killed one of the dogs in the building and he's eating it. People are holed up in their apartments, you know, this is, and then it goes back to the beginning when everything's nice and utopian and, you know, happy. But this architectural space as this kind of like kind of a sender and a receiver of these psychological pressures was very interesting to me. And the idea of a building as a kind of antenna in the way of, you know, all these lives sort of being broadcast, and the sort of the pressure of the city also just sort of, you know, coming in to this large receiver of a structure, which also includes the antenna sort of falling into ruin, if you will, as the building is subject to desire or rejection. Another book by Ballard that I sort of had in mind as I was working was called Concrete Island. It's another short novel. It's essentially about there's an architect, he's driving home from a party, and he goes off the freeway and, you know, goes through the rail barrier and into this dead zone between in this in-between space between multiple highways. And it's also like the 70s, so there's no cell phones. So he crashes over, and of course he's an architect, which is, you know, part of the sour irony here. But his car, he's hurt enough that he can't hike himself back up to the highway because his leg is messed up or something, and he was maybe a little drunk or something. But nobody can also see him. So he's stranded in the middle of this, you know, sort of like zone in between the highways, and he's realizes he's going to die, and he's sort of like trying to figure out, you know, how, what to do. And, you know, sort of events start to get more strange, and there's a moment where you're not sure if he's becoming mad or if he's really seeing the things that he's seeing. He starts questioning whether or not the island is in fact a kind of manifestation of his own mind, and, you know, all these things start to happen. But indeed, in the places that I've lived most recently, there certainly were lots of these sort of islands or dead zones or voided spaces. And we see that in, you know, I think probably almost every city worldwide. The title of the, I think I misplaced this slide actually, but just the title of the talk that I proposed about a gray ecology is just a very short borrow from Paul Virilio, the French philosopher. And he introduced this term, although I'm using it in a sort of different way. He talks about an ecology of distances and a pollution of distances, which I think is appropriate here. So the project that I started thinking about involved these sort of like notions of archaeological or historical, social, sonic space, and the city as a kind of metabolic entity, right? So it's not terribly difficult, even in a visual way, to see the city as this sort of like organism with circulation and arteries and you know, and then you start thinking of the city also in terms of its waste functions or its waste mechanisms, and that would include space, but unfortunately that often also includes people. In Los Angeles, where I was living and going to architecture school, there's a huge homeless population. I forgot the numbers, but I think there are even several hundred thousand, because it's so warm, and you know, you can actually live if you sleep all night, you know, outside. Near where I went to school, it's incredible actually. If you just, you know, go a few blocks away, block after block, it's like it's just tents and boxes and everything. Just all the sidewalks are just lined with, you know, people sleeping, and it's become their sort of their impromptu village. And then what happens every once in a while is the Los Angeles Police Department, they come in, they set up barricades around the area, and then they move in and they confiscate tents and boxes because it's illegal to erect any protective shelter over your head, while you're in public space. So it's like you can sleep on the sidewalk only if you're totally exposed to the, you know, elements. It's not illegal to sleep on the sidewalk or to sleep in a park. It's illegal to erect a protective barrier. So that includes a box or a tent, of course, or anything, fabric or whatever. So they sweep through and just take all that stuff, and then also sometimes have a few arrests and whatnot. But Los Angeles being such a driving city, meaning, you know, based around the automobile, led me to, and this is Houston, also a similar situation, huge city with very much designed around the car, and also a large homeless population. So the idea was to take a radio receiver. I didn't build it. I was able to buy it, and I just had to just screw in the housing. But it was a now I'm forgetting, like a 5-watt transmitter or something like that. So in order to purchase this, they would only sell it to certain categories of institutions. So I had to become ordained as a minister online and register a church, which I called the House of Infinite Transmissions. And I was the reverend. And then they would allow me to buy this transmitter because it was for, you could buy it if you were a church, or if you owned a sports stadium, you could buy it and put it in your sports stadium, or maybe for security or something in a factory. I forgot, but there were only certain, you know, it's beyond FCC allowable, like just amateur or, you know, individual citizen broadcasting power. But I guess the map was roughly, or the in ideal conditions, it was like 3 miles. So I just rigged it up to my car at the time and stuck the transmitter in the trunk and then ran, it was a coaxial antenna that I could just strap onto a bike rack. So it actually was fairly incognito, which was good, and then run the antenna down through, and my old Volvo had a, from the trunk into the back seat, has a little flap for ski poles for the, you know, Swedish design. So I could have the transmitter in the trunk and run the antenna just sort of discreetly out the window. So I drove around making essentially clandestine broadcasts. The idea was to use the bands of the, like essentially the top 10 Los Angeles radio stations. And the idea is that if you are closer to the listener than the broadcasting tower is, you can overpower temporarily that signal. And I think it's sort of a radio warfare technique called ghosting or something like that when you do. Because I was going to school in this area with many people that were sort of living in what I saw as a kind of like a city wasteland, or, you know, the sort of void space, I don't know if I could say befriended them, but we would chat, and I would, you know, ask them if they wanted to be involved. And ended up working with a few people, and I would give them some, you know, small recorders that they would take and record. So this is just a little transcript. I'll play you a short excerpt from a woman that I was working with named Anita. And she made this recording, you know, she took the recorder and she, you know, went home or wherever she was going, home in quotes. And made a recording, then we would meet up like a few days later and she would give me the recorder and I would transfer it and put it in a broadcast. What surprised me so much about her recording was the intense threshold of noise. And I think she was probably under an overpass, and she stayed very far away from everyone else, maybe because of safety or something like that. She was really kind of a loner. But some of the things that she says on the recording, I can't tell at all what she's saying because it's just lost in this wall of noise. But then some of the things she says, she's talking about sound, and it made me think she was like a natural-born sound artist. But unfortunately, it's all lost, and these are a few of the things that she says. So maybe I can just play really quickly a short excerpt from her recording that we broadcast in the mobile station.
Going along with my ears. It's what I'm holding with my through my ears. Ears. Eight times ears. Ears. What you would actually call. Now I am going to lower my tongue to the back of my bottom teeth. But let's say, if we were walking and talking, and making some very different sounds. But you might hear me swallowing something. If we could talk a little. Yesterday, I surprised. I didn't say anything particular. He just said some sounds. It could be the traffic all night long, I guess. But with that traffic, you can, as I do sometimes with such key, I was going to call. If I record, if I write a song or something. I sometimes you trip. You trip. And I did. But of the sounds, you know, that would be my instrument. And sometimes, you know, I let my pants. Their eyes, you know, they all get together and they make their noises too. You know, with being a ventriloquist, which I'm not going to do that right now, but a ventriloquist can probably just, I mean, I can be around you and you're really actually thinking this too. Really, really cool. I went to a lot of school in Berlin. You know, I can't do that right now. Well, it's not too good. But there'll be no will. I'll get back into doing this a little later. We've got heavy traffic, you know, we've got nice engine sounds, we've got heavy engine sounds. And you can hear a lot of different, you can hear about different speech motor.
So the idea here was really to try to perform this perforation, you know, to perforate architectural space and to send this sound, you know, through walls and get someone to question the barriers, you know, the boundaries of their sort of, I don't know, their spatial envelope. And I thought, you know, if somebody's at home or in their own car, you know, listening to whatever station, and then this strange thing drifts in and sort of takes over, and they would be like, fiddling with stations and trying to, you know, but then, you know, maybe curiously going back to see like what was that or something like that, you know, how it would create this sort of spatial glitch that would be always unresolvable, but would sort of maybe disturb the question, you know, at least to some extent, maybe provoke some alteration in the perception of that space. So, thank you.
Thanks very much for that. We have some time for comments or questions. There are microphones on either side if people want to step up.
Thanks very much. It's kind of the recordings of one of the things I was thinking was it's a nice sort of not counter, but in relation to Andrew's piece. I don't know if you saw his presentation, but just these really sort of clear recordings of people talking about Dawson City. And so
right.
The quality of your recordings and those two sort of different spaces, the recordings are quite nice in both instances because they seem to really kind of capture maybe the sonic and social space in a really interesting way.
Yeah.
Which is maybe more of a comment, which you're welcome to comment on. But my question, I guess, is I was wondering if you had, like, maybe what the feedback was from your fellow architecture students and professors and what they sort of thought of the project?
Yeah, actually, I went to a pretty experimental and conceptually minded school, of course. So they were accepting this as architecture, which was great. This sort of like, you know, sonic spatial practice. I actually didn't design a single building while I was there. I just did like radio broadcasts and urban games, and then like text projects. And you know, they were very experimentally minded in that sense. But the thing that I guess my fear though is that it can fall within the realm of I don't know what to say, maybe almost kind of like a novel sort of curiosity, and architecture as a, you know, in the most general sense is really about adding to the environment, not so much about subtracting from. And of course I'm adding a sound, but I was conceiving of subtracting a wall, you know. We did have some interesting conversations about it, and a lot of the social, I think that it was, you know, the conversations were more focused around questions of social space and access to space and publicness and things like that. Yeah. But the intention, I mean, I had to resist turning the recordings into, you know, something that sounds really cool, because, you know, that's just another side that I think for myself anyway, I can't help sometimes. I want it, you know, to sound this certain way. But I realized at a certain, you know, very quickly, I probably started putting some reverb or doing something to it and, you know, putting it in Ableton. And then I was like, no, this, I don't know what I'm doing here. You know, this is not what this is about. You know, this is really a document, you know. So I wanted to leave that clear sense of a document if I could.
Other comments or questions? I have a quick question about... also about your subjects, your recording subjects, how you came to choose the people for that and what their experience was from that. Did you have some feedback from them about the recordings? What did they think of? Did they listen to each other's recordings? Did they only listen back to their own?
That's been an interesting sort of ongoing question that I probably can't totally sort out. It was my experience, essentially, well, to answer the first part, it was people that I would sort of encounter a lot. I would, you know, maybe a lot of them were, you know, in the same area, or they weren't all near my school, some were near my house, you know, and I would see the same person, like, you know, every day or every other day or something. A big thing is pushing the shopping carts and collecting all the cans and whatnot, you know, and trying to sell it for scrap. So you can hear them coming from, you know, five blocks down or something. And I could say, oh, Anita's coming, because it's like Wednesday and she always comes through on Wednesday morning. So I could go down and like be on the sidewalk and meet her and chat a little bit. And we would visit and she would tell me stories about how she used to be a model and all these things that she used to do and, you know, things. And it was sort of surreal in some ways. I mean, the thing that I can never sort out about that situation is how did this happen? You know, that question of, you know, maybe her being in her situation. And that was a really difficult part of the process for me, because I didn't want to feel as though I was exploiting somebody or, you know, I don't know, like... I don't know what to. Losing the words for what that might be. The other thing that I was surprised by though was how some of these folks, they do interact with technology a lot. They just don't have a storage, a physical storage space to like keep things, like, you know, or store things in a way. But they, you know, in their backpack, they have a laptop and they have a cell phone and they have certain things, at least some of them, but they don't, you know, I don't know. And that, so that was strange. And some of, I know some of the folks, they did actually listen to the broadcast because they all have radios. So that was like, that was actually very prevalent. And that first inspired the idea is I saw so many homeless people, but they all had radios, and I thought this is kind of like a sort of way to sort of interact, you know, with this situation maybe.
Yeah, because there's a research method or approach called participant action research, or PAR. And the idea there is definitely to as you work with the subjects of your sort of your interest or your area of curiosity, then the subjects who participate also have quite a bit of agency to decide how you disseminate the work or sort of where the project goes. So one thing that I could imagine being an interesting development is to ask, sort of enlist them into, like, how does this broadcast work, and who's it for, and where do we take it in the city, and you know, could you saddle up somebody's cart with a transmitter, and you know, is that something they would be interested in? Like, just to sort of find out also, like, what their perception is as sort of sender receivers, that could be interesting. Because it struck me just from listening to, you know, the choice of location that Anita uses to do her recording, it's like not the thing that we would necessarily choose, because you're like, oh, there's a lot of background sound. But it gives so much context about where she's spending her day. So
absolutely.
And sort of who she is, this intimate voice against this sort of monstrous car culture. So,
absolutely.
So I'm very curious to know, you know, what the same person would think of in terms of where would she want to broadcast, or who is she thinking of listening to her voice?
So, right. She knew that, I mean, the way I explained it was like, this is going to be broadcast throughout the city, and it's just like, you know, multitudes of anonymous listeners, or perhaps no one, you know, it all depends on this, like, you know, where the station is going and what band it's on and who happens to be listening at that moment. But it was really this sort of like spreading sort of action, you know. And so the way I posed it was like, you know, I introduced the idea that they would have some anonymity as well. And I said, you know, if you could say anything, knowing that someone might be listening, you know, you can do that. Like, you can say anything you want. I won't edit it or, you know, change it or anything like that. It's, you know, you can address the city if you would like to. I guess I expected more rants, you know, but I never got that. It was always way more personal and idiosyncratic, and you know, that may just be by chance with the small group of like six people that I worked with, but I'm not sure.
Thanks, I've really enjoyed it. Cool. I was often thinking about like graffiti and how the project relates to graffiti as a kind of sonic graffiti, especially in terms of like ghosting, how you were like taking over the station in the same way that like graffiti artists will take over a billboard.
Definitely.
I was just wondering if you saw that connection or.
Yes, you're absolutely, absolutely right. I it is a kind of like a sonic graffiti. It's a, you know, and it's certainly not authorized, you know, and it's sort of appropriating an available surface or something in a way. So it's very much in that way. I guess aside from Babbage's notion, it doesn't last. It doesn't stick around. I mean, in his thought, it would, you know, it is still around, but I can follow that as well. But it's a kind of like a temporary graffiti in a kind of way, for sure. Or even with the way I, you know, just mentioned by Virilio, a kind of a pollution of distances, you know, in a certain way. I think it applies to that as well, definitely. Cool. Yeah.
I think we have to move on to the next presentation.
Cool.
Thanks again
Great.
To Abinadi Mesa for great paper.
Thank you.